With your Amex card, entertainment benefits like special ticket access and pre-sales to select can't-miss events while supplies last, make every tap music to your ears.
Calling all men. When was the last time you had a really good cry? A recent survey found that women cry on average 5 times a month, while men cry on average only once a month. Studies have shown that crying can support your mental, your physical, and your emotional health. I'm Radhi Devlukia, and on my podcast, A Really Good Cry, we embrace the real, the messy, and the beautiful. Listen to A Really Good Cry on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Crossover Sports Illustrated's NBA show, breaking down the latest news, rumors, and everything in between. Here's your hosts, Chris Mannix, Rohan Akhmi, and Chris Herring.
And we are back, Crossover NBA podcast. Chris Mannix, the author of the book you're now hearing about again, Blood in the Garden. Chris Herring, who, in addition to covering the Knicks Heat series for SI, he is shamelessly using it as an opportunity to push his book out there as well.
Damn right.
Right, Chris? Damn right. So pick it up if you have not read it already. A terrific book, Blood in the Garden by Chris Herring. And from his dorm room in Miami, Rohan Nadkarni. What's up, Rohan?
No books. No books. Just vibes for me.
No books. No books. Vibes. He's got some vinyl records down out there, I think. I think that's
I do have my Florida Panthers hat on in honor of
the greatest
upset in NHL history. Shout out to the Cats.
Yeah, you know, look, I'm a Bruins fan, but like hockey, if there's a more meaningless regular season than the NBA's, it's the NHL's, right? Mm-hmm. Like, all you need in hockey is a hot goalie and a couple of breaks, really. That's all you need. Like, the Bruins, I think all season long, they lost, what, four games at home, and then they lose three straight to Florida at home. So there's no rhyme or reason for things that happen in hockey. It's such a weird sport.
What a great playoff sport, though.
It is.
Great.
But it is truly yeah. Just so random, though. Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of it.
It's so fun to watch in person.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not a hockey on television watcher. I am a big-time hockey in-person watcher. It's a lot of fun to do that on its own. All right, a lot I want to get into in this show. I want to talk about the Celtics' absolute meltdown on their home floor on Monday. We have a 2-0 series lead for Denver, which could turn out to be a sweep, depending on Chris Paul's injury. But I first want to lead, guys, with the news that broke this afternoon, courtesy of The Athletic. The Memphis Grizzlies, in their exit interview with Dylan Brooks, have informed Dylan Brooks that under no circumstances are they going to bring him back this year. The language used by The Athletic was very specific. It was very clear that the Grizzlies have no interest and will not make Dylan Brooks any offers as he hits free agency in July. We kind of knew it was trending this way. Zach Kleiman, the GM of the Grizzlies, gave a press conference a couple of days ago where he refused to answer any questions about Dylan Brooks. Ja Morant, during his exit interview with the media, did not list Dylan Brooks among the team leaders that were going to rebuild this thing moving forward. But Chris Herring, I tell you, it was wild to read a report in early May that the Grizzlies have informed their free agent to be one of the better defensive players in this league that they have no interest in bringing him back. What did you make of that?
Yeah, this was weird. And I also think it's weird sometimes to see the internet react to it as opposed to us as reporters, where we've covered Baggy Day, we've covered the exit interviews and stuff like that. Players are told all the time, I think sometimes, as harsh as it sounds, it's actually doing the players a favor to, and their agents a favor to, kind of know ahead of time what to expect contract-wise, if they're going to be offered anything. So that happens, but players of Dylan Brooks' caliber, a guy that I imagine will get all defensive team votes and stuff like that, a guy that, you know, for how awful he was in the playoffs and just how much the guy talks, is not a bad basketball player necessarily. He's not great, but he has skills in this league, and at times he's been a much better player than he was in the postseason. He's a decent player, and if you can rein him in, or if you get the right people, players around him in that organization, maybe he doesn't look as ridiculous as he did this year. But it's not, I don't think it's common for guys of that caliber to hear it that way. And the part that's really not common is for it to leak. When would they have had their exit interviews? Yesterday? The day before?
Last couple of days, yeah.
That's really not common. You don't hear it leak. I mean, normally guys are at a much lower level when they're just told, we're not going to bring you back. You know, if you need any references or anything like that around the league, we've got you, but we're not going to bring you back. This is unusual. And I'll say, like, it's a little funny, not funny. It's not a funny situation, but it's a little interesting to read language that strong and to see a report about it this quickly after the fact, when this is a team that needs a complete overhaul from a cultural standpoint of the sorts of people they have in the locker room, everything like that. I don't think this was really a knock on his talent, but the truth is Ja Morant created a lot more conversation around this team's culture than Dylan Brooks did. And there's not going to be a conversation had about whether the Grizzlies are going to bring him back or anything like that, because he has so much talent. So they need to ask some hard questions. I mean, it'll be really easy to write this off as a Dylan Brooks thing. And if we just remake that position and remake whether he's in the locker room or not, we're good. That might not be the reality. I think that they can and should move on from Dylan Brooks. We talked about this, I think, on Friday, Chris, but it's still, like, it'll be really interesting to see what the next steps are, because you can blame him for now, and I think he deserves some of the blame for now, but I think they need more fixes than just him, to be honest with you.
You know, Rohan, this is clearly reactionary by the Grizzlies, because The Athletic notes that Memphis made Dylan Brooks contract extension offers during the regular season. So they thought enough of him as a 23-year-old, or 27-year-old, I should say, defensive-minded wing, that they made him offers to stay long-term. Six games into a Lakers series, they decide, no, we're not going to do it. Does this feel a little too knee-jerk to you?
That's an interesting question, especially given the context of the extension offer. I will say this. It might be a little bit knee-jerk, but even if you ignore the off-the-court stuff, of which there was plenty, I mean, you could have just made that decision based on that alone. I think we saw how he hurts this team in the playoffs. If this is a team that's serious about going far in the playoffs, they can't have him jacking up 15 shots a night, missing 10 of them. They can't have him taking all these threes. They can't have him getting into these spats with the opposing team's best players. Like, that's just not good for what they're ultimately trying to accomplish, which is win a championship. There's a team that obviously fashions itself a contender. We've talked multiple times on this podcast about, well, where do they need an upgrade? They need an upgrade on the wing. We know that they tried to get Mikal Bridges and OG Anunoby at the trade deadline. So they've also been aware of that, too. They need more shooting on the wing. They need someone who, frankly, isn't going to sink their offense, not only because he can't shoot, but because he refuses to stop shooting. So I do think it's definitely, there's a knee-jerk aspect to it, I guess you could say. But even if you ignore the off-the-court stuff, I think they're reacting to the right things. Like, he was not good for them in the playoffs, and even defensively, the job he was asked to do, it's not like he, granted, you know, this is an entirely different conversation. LeBron has not been playing like full-on LeBron playoff mode just yet, but it's not like Dylan Brooks was coming up with huge stops in key moments when they needed time and time again. He also wasn't really playing his best defense either. So I think it's reactionary. I definitely think they're probably caught up in how embarrassing and upsetting the end of their season was. But I think this, he hurt them enough on the court to justify this decision.
Yeah, Herring, I disagree. I don't think he hurt them enough for them to just say, we're done with you, especially when there isn't a obvious replacement on the roster. I'm sorry, David Roddy is fine, young player, but he ain't the defensive player Dylan Brooks is. Zaire Williamson might be the guy that steps into that role, but right now he didn't show enough to even get off the bench in that Lakers series. So I just think this feels a little bit too reactionary. Like, maybe you come to this decision in early June after you have a little bit of time to let things settle down a little bit. Remember, Dylan Brooks, he shot 23% from three in that series against the Lakers. That was awful. His shooting was part of the reason that they lost. But he was like 33% from three during the regular season, which, while still not a good number, look, he's better than like Russell Westbrook and better than Giannis even, like better than a lot of guys in this league. And at 27, I think you opened the door for the possibility that he could get better from three-point range. So I don't know. Look, they said, Zach Kleiman said, they're going to be aggressive in the offseason. They've got five first-round picks they could potentially deal. They've got a few really interesting pieces on the roster, young player-wise, that could be compelling to teams that are looking to deal 3-and-D wings. But without an obvious replacement, to just say to Dylan Brooks, we're done with you. Look, if they don't get that replacement, it's a step back. Like, they're going to take a step back as a team if they don't get somebody as good or better as Dylan Brooks is defensively.
They might. I mean, it's a good likelihood that they will. I mean, there were so many times during the season that I wanted them to just be able to pour fertilizer on Zaire Williams, just because I think that I want to say 2 or 3 years ago, I wrote about the 5 or 6 guys that were most critical going into whatever season that was. And I think I had said that Brooks was one of those guys, just because he was so inconsistent, but also he was starting to kind of become more of a pain in the butt to other teams, and you wondered about the guy's focus and different things like that. He's always been someone that is capable of getting in foul trouble. He's always been a little bit here and there with regards to his shooting, but you look at the trend of his shooting, and I think that's kind of the concern from a contract standpoint. He was 30, just a hair under 36% as a rookie, a hair under 38% his second year, and then it was 36%, 34%, 31%, this year 32%, almost 33%. So the trend wasn't good, and as Rohan has said a couple times, he's taking so many more of them than he was when he first got in the league, that I think that's the real problem, is just kind of like, you've got to have more to your game at that point. You've got to be able to counter if the threes aren't falling. Are you going to the basket? Are you making defenses have to account for you? So yeah, I agree with you that I don't know what advantage there is to saying that loudly and decisively that you're not going to bring him back. Not so much, again, maybe you can tell him that, but the idea of it getting out league-wide, it kind of feels like you're more trying to send a message about the culture of the team and the direction that you want the team to take. I'm curious to see who they get. I really do think that's the sort of question that can dictate whether or not this team is a contender next year, whether they win a championship anytime soon. But they don't have a ready guy to just kind of step right into that role. They're going to have to trade for somebody. And I'm very, very curious to see who it'll be, because it'll be a big question for this team.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people predicting that this is the NBA end for Dylan Brooks. It's not. It's not.
No.
A 27-year-old with that kind of defensive chops, he's going to be fine. I mean, I didn't have Dylan Brooks on either of my all-defensive teams, but I was very close to putting him on second team. I think it was down for me between Dylan Brooks and Lou Dort, and I gave Lou Dort the nod. But his age, his upside, somebody's going to give him a legitimate contract.
And, can I say one thing?
Yeah.
I was having a conversation. Me and Howard Beck, our old teammate, were sitting next to each other at game one of Knicks Heat. And I can't remember what prompted the conversation about Dylan Brooks. I think it was maybe that he had declined, for the second or third game in a row to talk to the media. And we were talking about just like how tenuous his grasp on a spot there with Memphis was looking even before this. And the fact that, that Zach Kleiman had said that you know, he did not do the team any favors by all the, you know, all the stuff he said during the series. So my question for Howard or vice versa, I can't remember who asked it, was like, where does he fit? Like, he's not a great shooter. He is the sort of player that, like, you know, if you want to use the word toxic, some people would say that. I don't know if I would quite go that far, but he's certainly a character, and not every locker room wants that. Not every locker room needs that. And I feel like to even want him in your locker room, you've got to have enough people in your locker room that you feel like can kind of keep his head on straight. And so, you know, there are teams that need that. There are teams that don't. But I was having a tough time trying to think of, like, what team really fundamentally needs that. The only one I could even think of, and Howard seemed to agree with, he's like, that's a really good one that I hadn't thought of. And even them, I'm not sure about. We just watched them take a 2-0 lead last night. I think the Nuggets could be interesting if they don't win this year. They're a team that I think sometimes is looked at as being maybe not stout enough defensively and maybe doesn't have enough of, like, a rugged nature to them. That said, Aaron Gordon looked great yesterday on Kevin Durant. I'm sure we'll talk about all that. And they've got Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. So this team is maybe a little bit different than the ones they've had. And they have enough what you would think is maybe locker room leadership there with Jokic and some of the other guys that maybe you could absorb somebody like him. And he could be a backup wing for you as opposed to being someone that has to play. But the question of how much would it cost, whether they even want him. I mean, like, it really is going to be GM specific here as to what teams want to take a chance on him. But he's not done in the NBA by any means. I think someone will be happy to have him. It's more a question of what is he being paid and what will he cost. And that, to me, gets back to your initial question of, like, is it surprising that the Grizzlies didn't at least wait and see here? And I think to some extent it is a little surprising, but I'm just more surprised that that it was megaphoned to this extent, that they're not bringing him back under any circumstances, as if he was the one that had criminal stuff or, you know, questions about criminal stuff in the background. That just wasn't the case. This is a question of whether the guy is maybe a bit dirty as a player, whether he is a loudmouth, and that's a different question than just, is he worth it as a player? Is he a problem off the court? I feel like this is a different sort of question.
I don't see a contender picking him up. I don't see a good team taking a chance on him. I could see an up-and-coming team that's like, we need an injection of someone with playoff experience, someone who's going to bring a certain edge or attitude to our younger group. But I don't see a team. I know you mentioned Denver specifically. Like, that team is such good chemistry. I just can't see a contender taking a chance on someone like him coming up and either blowing up the locker room or hurting them in a big moment. Like, I can't see a big team. I know, like, the internet joke is like, oh, Dylan Brooks, like, welcome to Charlotte. I don't know that he's going to go to the home, but I could see him going, or like a lesser playoff team, but I can't see him signing with a legit contender. That I just could not imagine why anyone would take that chance.
Nah, I just can't. I can see him signing with a contender because I just think we're too close to the end of that Lakers series. I mean, they just lost to maybe the best seventh seed of all time. And, you know, throughout the regular season, Dylan Brooks has been a highly effective defensive player. Mm-hmm. The swagger, the moxie that Memphis plays with, this what they take so much pride in, Dylan Brooks was a big part of that. Like, he was a big part of the culture, for better or for worse. And a lot of times it was better. Before things kind of went downhill with John Morant, we were kind of praising the Grizzlies for some of the swagger that they had. Like, this is a league, guys, that is built around three, you know, wing players, high-scoring wing players. You know, whether it's, you know, look at it, we're talking about Philadelphia and Boston in a second. You know, Harden, Maxey, Tatum, Brown. Like, there's so many wing guys. If you can get a all defensive team level wing at a reasonable contract, you're going to do it. Like, you're just going to do it. Like, Rohan, you're down there in Miami. Like, you think the Heat would care about Dylan Brooks's mouth? Or
I think that if he was more talented, I definitely think they'd see it as like a Heat move.
Talented. Like, we'll bring this guy they extract talent out of players like nobody I've ever seen. Like, I think they'd find a place for him. The shooting is obviously a problem. They like shooters down there in Miami, but you think about the reclamation projects they've had over the years and what they've done with them. I mean, they turned Hassan Whiteside into a max player. I mean, come on. Like, this is, yeah. They could find a way to resuscitate Dylan Brooks. That actually, I think, is a team to watch for Dylan Brooks if the money comes down significantly for him this offseason. All right.
I'm more interested in the contract, though, real quick. Like, if you have to ballpark a number, what do you think it's going to be?
I don't know. I think that $12 million exception is, you know, might be his range right now. But look, there could be a team that says, we'll give you 15, 16 per year. But I don't think so. I think the new economics of the NBA, because of the collective bargaining agreement, are going to change things a lot starting this summer.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Calling all men. When was the last time you had a really good cry? A recent survey found that women cry on average 5 times a month, while men cry on average only once a month. Studies have shown that crying can support your mental, your physical, and your emotional health. I'm Radhi Devlukia, and on my podcast, A Really Good Cry, we push against typical societal norms. We embrace the real, the messy, and the beautiful, providing a space for raw, unfiltered conversations that celebrate vulnerability and allow you to tune in to share, connect, and find comfort together.
Our tears come as a way to let us release what we can't hold anymore.
And I trust that no one's ever going to find out those deepest, darkest secrets.
Yeah, it's been a hard day. She walks out, and this is what she looks like.
Oh my gosh, give her an Oscar!
Listen to A Really Good Cry with me, Radhi Devlukia, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, let's talk about the Celtics and the Sixers, that just biblical meltdown by Boston. They give up 88 points to Tyrese Maxey, James Harden, and De'Anthony Melton, the latter of which I can't believe was part of all that. James Harden himself goes for, what, 39 in game
45.
One? 45. 45? Was it 45? Yeah. I must have blacked out in the last six. The last three of which, of course, were
the game winner.
Three-pointer. Yeah, the game winner in the face of Al Horford there. You know, it wasn't too long ago I was in front of Marcus Smart's locker talking to him about how great Boston's wings were defensively. He thought they were the best wing trio in the league with Derek White and Malcolm Brogdon. And then those three guys just torched them. James Harden. You know, it's being called like Houston Harden. No. That was 4-year contract Harden. Like Harden, after that last three, probably looked in the stands at Daryl Morey and said, hey, pay me or I'm going to Houston. You know, give me that some of that money. I want to give the Sixers all the credit in the world for that because Harden stepped into that Joel Embiid role brilliantly. But man, what are the Celtics doing out there? Like they took their foot off the gas big time. They were outplayed. They were outworked. They were outcoached. Rohan, in every facet of the game, they got beaten by a team that was playing without the presumptive MVP. The MVP, who just like 3 weeks ago had to score 50 points to beat the Celtics in a home game. So what happened in this one?
God, this was a fascinating game. First of all, it's something that confounds me about Boston sometimes is, as you mentioned, they have a bunch of great wings defensively. This was a team last year that defensively switched incredibly effectively. They have an ability to play all different kinds of lineups. And for the life of me, I couldn't understand why Al Horford was out on the floor as much as he was, just getting roasted in drop coverage over and over again by James Harden. When you have other options, you can go smaller. You could play five wings. You could maybe play Grant Williams. Again, it's all easier said than done. But when you're getting roasted to that degree, it's like the Bucks, like maybe try something different instead. You know, they finally decide to switch with Horford on that last possession instead of drop, but we see that Harden not fazed by it at all. Charles Barkley brought this up on the post game, and it's kind of hard for me to disagree. He kind of mentioned, you've brought this up several times, Mannix, like Ime Udoka was not afraid to go at his players, publicly or privately, not afraid to really hold them accountable. And I just wonder if they are, you know, I don't think they were scared of Atlanta by any stretch. They clearly looked at Philly without Embiid and said, okay, we'll win this game. And I just wonder if anyone's lighting a fire under these guys right now. Like, defensively, this was a team top five in defense during the regular season. Last year had a fantastic defensive season. It should be better this year with the addition of Malcolm Brogdon. It slipped a little bit. Okay, it's an offense-heavy league. We get it. But in the playoffs, they've just been... It feels like they have not really had a playoff game yet, is how I would describe it, to be honest. Like, I think other teams were tested more in the first round. I think other teams just took their competition more seriously. Like, that's the vibe I get from Boston. It's like they haven't faced... I don't think they've played a game yet where they felt, like, on edge or a little bit on the ropes. And then last night, like, they let... Again, they I thought they let Harden get comfortable with some of their coverages. They didn't really do too much to adjust to it. And you see what happens. So I do wonder if they almost needed a loss like this. I've been high on Boston for 2 years. The second half of last season was one of the best stretches we've seen of any team outside of the Kevin Durant Warriors in the last few years. This year, they were the only team top five offense and defense. They should be the best team left in the playoff field. It just feels like, you know, they're kind of sleepwalking through this postseason because they haven't had to face a serious team yet.
You know, Herring, the number that stood out to me was the 10 shots that Jaylen Brown took in 42 minutes. 10 shots in 42 minutes. This was a guy that, in the last round, averaged 20 shots per game. He takes 10. And it wasn't like he was missing. He was 8 for 10 on those shots. It's like he went on strike in the second half of this game. It was wild to see. Yeah, I think there was a possession in like the last 4 minutes where Jaylen Brown looked like he had an opportunity for a fast break, kind of pulled the ball back and didn't, you know, try to finish it. I just so many weird things happened for Boston. After the game, Al Horford said, yeah, we probably took our foot off the gas a little bit knowing Joel Embiid was out. But, you know, I tend to agree with Rohan. Like, I would have liked to have seen more than 4 minutes from Grant Williams in this game. I would probably like to see 0 minutes from Sam Hauser for the rest of the series, since they keep hunting him on every possession that he's out there. There's a lot of cleaning up to do before game two, which I'm going to assume Joel Embiid is not going to play in, because why not try to get him a little bit more rest before game three, knowing you've already taken home court advantage back. But it's abundantly clear now, even without Embiid, this Sixers team can win.
Yeah, I mean, we've had conversations, and it's I feel like it's been an interesting playoffs from the standpoint of, like, which team do you trust? You know, the Lakers at times were struggling at the very end of this regular season with the Jazz that didn't even, you know, weren't even rolling out all their players, and obviously the Warriors couldn't win a road game. Denver struggled toward the end of the year, and I think fundamentally it may end up shifting the way that the MVP vote looks later tonight and different stuff like that. Boston, their struggle so much during the season, they just were not good when other teams' best players were out a lot of the time. And I think someone tweeted yesterday, I'm looking at it now, lost to Cleveland without Darius Garland, lost to the Warriors pretty badly without Wiggins, Murray missing from Denver, the 30-some point loss they had to Oklahoma City without Shea. Miami without Butler, Phoenix without Booker, New York without Brunson, and on and on and on. The game that they lost in this last series against Atlanta without DeJounte Murray, Washington without Beal. It just starts to kind of paint a picture a little bit of the idea of like this team doesn't seem to lock in and take their opponent seriously when they're not at full strength. And look, all credit to James Harden. He looked fantastic last night. We kind of laughed a little bit last week about the idea of like, oh, TMZ is saying he's in Vegas. Okay, you know, on some level, like, big deal. Like, they had so much time off. Your concern, if anything, was going to be, what if he's not locked in? And it actually looks like the opposite was true, is that the Celtics have really never had their foot on the pedal as much as they should. And, you know, that's kind of exactly what Rohan's point is, I think, about the question about Joe Mazzulla is like, how vocal are you? Ime Udoka is not afraid of doing that. Joe Mazzulla, every time I really hear him speak, and he's been like this, to his credit, he doesn't change at least, but he tends to look at the shot profile and says like, man, we didn't get up enough threes. And that might be part of it, but I also was very concerned right off the bat when I made this joke on Twitter yesterday. Boston was shooting like 126% yesterday for like the whole first half. They started, 13 for 13 inside like the paint, inside the restricted area, whatever it was, because there was no Embiid, and they were still only up by a couple of points at half. It actually struck me very similar to the Knicks Heat game in game one, where the Knicks were red hot to start the game, and all of a sudden you looked up, they looked like they were outplaying Miami by a ton, and they were only up by five at half. And the same feel was there with Boston yesterday of just they weren't playing defense either, and it was maybe going to get them beat. And I know the score wasn't abundantly high or anything like that, but you let Harden get into a rhythm like that without having Embiid there, and Maxey had to leave the game for a little bit too because of an injury he had. There's really no excuse if you're Boston. Your home court, there's no Embiid. You know, it took them too long. They should have done more to force the ball out of Harden's hands, given how well he was shooting. So I don't know what to think of this Boston team. Like, they should theoretically be the favorite, just given who's left in the West and the fact that they're going to beat up on each other. You get Embiid without, you know, you get the Sixers without Embiid. And on the other side of the spectrum, you've got a Heat and Knicks team that are probably going to bludgeon the hell out of each other without their top players, by the way. What are you doing if you're Boston? It's just, it needs to be a gut check moment for them. I expect them to be much better in game two. I would hope they are, because if they're not, it's really hard to view them as favorites, even though they should be.
Yeah, they let the Sixers shoot 50% from the floor, 43% from three without Joel Embiid. Like, this is a Celtics team that is known for its defense. Its identity is its defense. A top-rated defense once again this year during the regular season. That needs to be cleaned up. Game two is a call to arms for Marcus Smart, Derek White, and Malcolm Brogdon. They've got to be a lot better in this game.
Can we just talk real quick about those two plays at the end of the game, though? Two of the funniest things I've seen in my entire life. First, the shot clock play, the pass to Maxey, just truly one of, like, it looked like a under 12 game when that happened. It's like, I've never seen an NBA player just so thoroughly pass the ball to the other team before. And also, what was the play call when the Celtics were down two and it's Marcus Smart attacking James Harden and he doesn't even get a shot up? What was that the actual? I was looking through all the post game quotes that the reporters tweeted out, and I was assuming Joe Mazzulla was going to say something like, that wasn't the call. Marcus saw a matchup he liked. But I haven't seen anything like that.
It was inbounded to Marcus. There was only 8 seconds left. It was inbounded to him. So
why? Like, why?
Look, I think Marcus got caught in the air.
I guess. I don't know what that was.
I mean, he got to the rim. It was just a bad pass. Like, he tried to hand it off to Tatum in front of two bodies. It was just a bad pass. Like, if he had taken the shot, I probably would have been okay with it because it would have been a point-blank shot. Mm-hmm. And I think he was going up against Maxey, who at that point had five fouls.
Against Harden, but who's not
Harden? But yeah, either way, like I didn't mind that. You know what I think is going to be interesting? I'm going to predict today that PJ Tucker gets upgraded to a flagrant foul because of that groin shot.
Like, really?
I've watched that like 10 times, Wow. Somebody tell me what PJ Tucker was doing. Like, unless he was trying to make contact with Jason Tatum.
I thought
somebody
he was,
tell me what he was doing.
I thought he was like frustrated like with a teammate and just turned.
He swung that, thing, but he swung that hand.
He swung, but it was like he would have had to have had eyes in the back of his head to do it. Like it, I felt like I looked
that
at
looked
it
like a shot.
They were like they were they me. Were split on the broadcast. They were split on the broadcast.
Okay.
And I'm with Mannix. It's like it's okay. Like the Mona Lisa of groin shots. It's like if you depending on how you
I
look
mean,
at
he hit
it,
him
it's
square
like did he do it on
the...
purpose? Did he not do it on purpose?
I felt that one.
There's yeah, no debating was, whether he hit him squarely. I maybe I need to look at it again. I felt like when I watched it, it seemed like I was almost stunned at how square he hit him, how squarely he hit him, despite not looking at him to do it. So I legitimately thought he was frustrated with the teammate for like a blown defensive assignment.
It was mid-play. He was yelling at a teammate, and he is a pretty demonstrative guy. That's the kind of he is swinging his.
Sometimes people swing. You remember Carl Anthony Towns almost ended a referee?
Yeah,
like a week ago.
First round,
like people
yeah.
swing. True, we've seen Carlos Boozer hit a referee before. Those are refs, by the way, not players. But
the accuracy with which PJ Tucker landed.
I will say
that was an accurate shot.
If Embiid got a flagrant one for trying to hit someone in the groin but not doing it, and then Harden gets a flagrant two for hitting someone in the groin, even though he clearly didn't mean to do it, PJ's got to probably get a flagrant.
I think he gets upgraded.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
I think he gets bumped up to a flagrant one, and that just adds to his first, I believe, flagrant foul point. Because that was – I remember seeing Tatum down, and I'm like, oh, man, blew out his knee. Then you see
I didn't know what was happening. Oh, exactly. The replay was like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
That was brutal.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Calling all men. When was the last time you had a really good cry? A recent survey found that women cry on average 5 times a month, while men cry on average only once a month. Studies have shown that crying can support your mental, your physical, and your emotional health. I'm Radhi Devlukia, and on my podcast, A Really Good Cry, we push against typical societal norms. We embrace the real, the messy, and the beautiful, providing a space for raw, unfiltered conversations that celebrate vulnerability and allow you to tune in, to share, connect, and find comfort together.
Our tears come as a way to let us release what we can't hold anymore.
I trust that no one's ever going to find out those deepest, darkest secrets.
Yeah, it's been a hard day. She walks out, and this is what she looks like.
Oh my gosh, give her an Oscar!
Listen to A Really Good Cry with me, Radhi Devlukia, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, let's talk about the Nuggets and the Suns. Denver up 2-0 in this series after taking the first two at home. Just a disaster for Phoenix. And the icing on the cake is that Chris Paul has some kind of quad groin adductor injury in that area. The kind of injuries that don't generally heal in a couple of days. And Chris Paul has unfortunately known for these types of injuries. It's been a few years since we've heard, you know, Chris Paul's name associated with kind of one of these tissue, ligament, whatever kind of injuries. But here we are again with Chris Paul potentially having to miss time in this series. Rohan, you wrote about this over at SI.com. The Suns are in a lot of trouble for a lot of reasons. They're having a hard time slowing Denver down, but to your point and what you wrote, like they're just not playing modern basketball at the moment. They're not matching the output on three-point shots that Denver is.
It's really wild, you know, and it's funny in game two, I think they clearly seem to make it a focal point. And they did, to their, I guess, credit, missed a lot of open threes. But you look at some of the guys, you know, shooting their threes. Cam Payne is going to get ignored. Josh Okogie is going to get ignored. Kevin Durant was 2 of 12 for three. I mean, Durant missed a lot of looks in this game that I think if you give him again, he makes. But what's fascinating to me about the Suns is we watched the Warriors last year in the playoffs just immediately put the Nuggets defense on its heels, put the Nuggets defense in scramble mode. And to Denver's credit, you know, I think you can really see in this series it's a difference between one team has a lot of chemistry and has played together for a long time. The other team looks like they just got together a couple weeks ago, which is what happened. But when Denver is sending two to the ball, when they're putting Jokic at the level in these screens and he's out there hedging hard, you know, Devin Booker seeing kind of these two on the ball in the pick and roll, Durant seeing two on the ball in the pick and roll, the Suns have not done a good enough job of collapsing Denver's defense in those situations and getting kind of these swing threes. Chris Paul, before he got hurt, Chris Paul is a good shooter. He's always been a good three-point shooter in his career. He has a little bit of a slow release, but at no point in his career have you been like, Chris Paul can't shoot. He doesn't want to shoot catch-and-shoot threes. He's 31% in the playoffs, and you can see a lot of times when he's the guy getting the ball in that swing situation, he hesitates. He dribbles. He goes back into the offense. That is not his shot. He doesn't seem to be a shot that he's comfortable with. Okogie's getting ignored in the fourth quarter. The Nuggets just put Jokic on him and let him roam around defensively. So their problems are multifaceted. Number one, it's personnel. They don't have guys comfortable catch and shooting. Secondly, like, they just don't look like a team that knows how to play proper team basketball yet. Like, if you double Jokic, for example, the Nuggets know what they want to do. Like, he has chemistry. This guy's going to cut this way. I know KCP is going to be right here. How many times have you seen Jokic get a double and make a no-look pass to the corner, and you're like, how did he know that guy was there? It's like they just know. That's just how they've played all year. Whereas the Suns, it feels like they don't know how they want to collapse Denver's defense yet. And I give the Nuggets defense a ton of credit. Holding Phoenix to 87 points, even if Durant's having an off-shooting night, whatever, for a 2023 playoff game, that is remarkable. But this is not, you know, the 1996 Bulls. This is not the bad boy Pistons. The Suns, I think it's becoming very clear. They have not had enough time to figure out how to make best use of their players on the floor.
Herring, I've never been bullish on the Suns this season. Never. Not once. I thought they beat the Clippers because the Clippers are missing like a third of its roster, including its two best players. Or at least it's one best player at the start of that series. But the Suns, to me, have always looked like a team that needed a transaction cycle, that needed a full training camp, that needed to flesh out the roster around these star players. Like, there's very little precedent for succeeding when you have so many, have made a deal, the magnitude of the Durant deal, but it's just very difficult to coalesce, especially when the second you make the deal for Kevin Durant, he's out of the lineup like 5 minutes later with an injury. So to Rohan's point, I think chemistry matters. The Nuggets have great chemistry. Most of these guys have been together for 3, 4, 5 years. The Suns have zero. And now with the Chris Paul injury, I wouldn't be surprised to see Denver take two in Phoenix. I know it's kind of prisoner of the moment after watching the first two games, but No Chris Paul. Campaign can't shoot.
I don't think
the Nuggets defense is going to have, you know, better and better defensive game plans because of that. This is not a series I think Phoenix can be competitive in, even with a player the caliber of Kevin Durant.
Yeah, to your point, I don't think it's certainly not inconceivable that they sweep the series now without Chris Paul. I mean, I think even with him, certainly in Denver, you had the question just about stamina and altitude and the idea that you're going to be putting the ball in three guys' hands for the whole series to just ask them to create shots for you. And not just shots, but the ones that Rohan was talking about that aren't, they might be efficient for the Suns, but there's a different level of efficiency when you're talking about that versus the idea of, you know, in game one, letting everybody else take threes on you. Three is worth more than two, particularly if those are open shots and guys don't have to work their butts off to get those shots. So that's concerning now that Chris Paul may not be there. The idea of turning stuff over to Cameron Payne did not work yesterday. I think he got 16 minutes and was a minus 16 in that time. Looked brutal. There's just, you know, me, Rohan, and Michael Pien, another former friend of the pod, were texting earlier this weekend about the idea of this series and what to expect and what we're excited to watch. And I kind of figured that KD and Booker would be up to the challenge defensively. Game one, Booker got exposed, just really not helping much as a help defender and just not really closing off certain gaps. I mean, the Nuggets are a team that if you're not careful and if you don't have your head on a swivel, are going to back cut you to death because of Jokic's passing ability. They're able to do that. They've got multiple guys that can handle the ball. They've got good shooting everywhere. And they can get up and down and transition knowing that it's going to kill you. And this is a series where it's like you almost can't, at least in Denver, you almost can't run up and down the floor in transition because you just don't have the depth to be able to sustain that. You're going to have to use the same 6, 7, 8 guys. And oh, by the way, of those 6 or 7, like which ones are you using? Last night was not a night that Campaign probably should have been one of those people, even though I know that's the thought if Chris Paul gets hurt, but not if he's missing shots the way he was last night. You've got a few guys on that roster. I was a little bit surprised that weren't playing a little bit more. I get that he's not great defensively, but Terrence Ross is someone that can at least knock down a shot from time to time. But also you've got guys on this roster that don't want to shoot. And that's just as bad. At one point last night, Josh Okogie had what should have been a floater, mm-hmm. From about 3 feet away, oh, 4 feet yep. away, didn't take it. And it completely botched their possession. And it's like, you either are going to have to live with those guys shooting and they're going to have to take those shots. Mm-hmm. Or if they don't, you're going to ask Booker or Durant, who they're human. They're, you know, they're liable to have a bad shooting night every now and then, or to just wear down over the course of a game. Booker had moments where he was great last night, but he also has so many where he's forcing. And he's just, you know, dribble, dribble, dribble. And like that plays to Denver's advantage. Their defense gets to stand still. Whereas Denver is kind of forcing the Suns to move all over because of all the guys they've got to cover and different things like that. If your strategy is to make Jokic beat you on his own, he's capable of that. And he did that yesterday after a game one where Murray went crazy. So it just kind of seems like, you know, a game of chess where Denver's been playing this a lot longer and, you know, the Suns are a beginner at the sport. So I didn't think that I said I thought the Suns were a favorite, not necessarily in this series, but just generally speaking in the West. And I thought it played to their advantage that nobody else really looked like they had their stuff together either, especially Denver at the end of the season. But that doesn't mean that cohesion doesn't matter because we're seeing all the ways in which it does right now.
One thing I just want to add about the defense real quick. Denver is a bunch of players on this team whose job is defense first. You look at the lineup they closed with last night. They brought in KCP to help with their wing defense, Bruce Brown, Aaron Gordon. It's not that these guys are bad offensive players, but their job is to play defense first, be tough on the wing. Phoenix closes with one guy a night whose job is to play defense first. Like, you know, to our point about our conversation, like Durant, Booker, Chris Paul, DeAndre Ayton, at times are all capable of playing good individual defense, good team defense, but they all have their responsibilities are all. Their priorities are all in the offensive end, and I think that's a problem for them because when Durant and Booker are playing mid-40s, minutes wise, you know, I just don't think that they can play the kind of defense necessary against Denver when they're being asked to do as much as they are offensively.
Yeah. First of all, do you remember when Terrence Ross was a sought after commodity at the buyout market?
Yeah.
Or like Dallas and Phoenix were wrestling over him at the buyout market. It just goes to show that we should not ever put stock in players acquired via the buyout.
Jay Crowder,
market.
You know, too, barely played in that.
Jay Crowder, that same thing.
Buck series.
I would say the guy who no one expected to do well is the one playing the best, and that's Kevin Love. I don't think anyone's
Cleveland sitting at home, and I remember all those people tweeting at me. Kevin Love had to go. Kevin Love had to go. He wasn't happy there. Okay. Well, happy getting paid, that's for sure. Yeah. You know, Bruce Brown, you mentioned, and when I did my kind of scouts takes for this series, the guy that I talked to mentioned Bruce Brown as a potential difference maker. If Bruce Brown could make shots, he was so good defensively that he'd be a major plus for them. First game, 14 points, 7 for 11 from the floor. Second game, 9 points, 2 of 5 from the floor, 5 of 6 from the free throw line. He's having an impact. He's an impact player for them in this series. He has been fantastic. And I would like to also point out he's from Dorchester, Massachusetts. So shout out Bruce
Brown.
How
did he not get more money during the
offseason? He also went to the University of Miami. I just want to throw that out there.
Oh, gosh. Okay. I don't have a tie-in with Bruce Brown. I'll be the lone one here. But how he to me, and I remember when this happened, and I think I either wrote about him specifically or, you know, in my roundups of, like, best free agent moves, I think I had him at the top of the list. He was such a perfect fit with that team, and it was kind of stunning to me that there weren't teams that stepped up.
I think it's his offense. It was his offense. Like I don't think he's shown he could be a reliable, you know, perimeter player. But he's had I don't know if it called a breakout year, but a vastly improved year.
In
the postseason, what is he going, like 25 minutes per game for Mike Malone? That's huge for him.
No, I think he's easily been their best reserve. He's been fantastic. I did a story. I was in San Francisco the first week of the season when the Nuggets were playing there, the opening week of the season. I asked Calvin Booth, how were you able to sign Bruce Brown? Even if he's not good offensively, he showed in Brooklyn he'll hit enough threes. He shot like 41% on all wide open threes last year. But he showed in Brooklyn like he's an adaptable player. In Brooklyn, he was playing a big man role. In Denver, he's back to playing point guard. I was like, how did you sign him? Like, how did you convince him? He's like, we were shocked he was available. The Nuggets couldn't believe it. Calvin Booth literally called it, in the story, he calls it a watershed moment that they were able to sign Bruce Brown, because that's the kind of guy in the past.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what
he's making signing.
Yeah. That guy always signs with a different team, but huge for Denver. I think I said in the summer he was my favorite offseason signing, and to me, he's lived up to it for sure.
All right, before we go, Lakers-Warriors starts on Tuesday night. This is the marquee series of the second round. LeBron James and Steph Curry, part 5. We're not really going to include the play-in game from a couple of years ago. That's not really postseason. But as far as postseason series goes, part 5 between two of the best players of this generation. I was at Laker practice on Monday when Darvin Ham called it, you know, unequivocally the best rivalry of this generation. It's hard to really come up with a better one considering the stages that these guys have played on. 4 straight NBA finals. Steph leads 3-1, but in fairness to LeBron, Steph has had some probably better teammates in most of those series going up against LeBron. But this is a really interesting matchup. I have another scout's take on this online at SI.com right now. And the first thing my scout said to me was that the Warriors are significantly better. So let's start there, Herring. Are the Warriors significantly better going into this series?
I'm not going to say significantly. I mean, I also think it's one of those things where they could win the series 4-1, 4-2. And I mean, just roster-wise, I wouldn't necessarily say that makes them like significantly better, even though I guess that is in some ways the measure of how you do that. Like, I don't think we would say that the Heat were, you know, massively better than the Bucks.
Wow.
I wouldn't say that. Maybe Ron would, but like I think you can have a series where something happens the way it happens. And you know, I don't know what to make of that. It's matchups, it's injuries sometimes. I'm curious. I will say that they could look significantly better. Maybe they are significantly better if the Lakers don't have a clear-cut way to guard Steph. And I think I imagine that that's going to be what a lot of people's eyes are on, is what do the Lakers do lineup wise? They have a lot of size. They're very, very good on the glass. But they're the maybe the best person that they've got to guard Steph Curry is not someone that's in their starting lineup. It's certainly not D'Angelo Russell. And so how do you make use of him in this series? Yeah. What do you do with that? Do you alter your lineup? Do you even alter your starting lineup to try to account for that? So I think that's a big question. I also think that, you know, if the Warriors, for whatever reason, are not shooting particularly well and try to go to the basket and try to get things at the basket, what does that look like? Because Anthony Davis is a beast. And I think that the Lakers have ways of defending the rim in a way that, you know, that would make the Warriors a lot more comfortable. Like, I can't think of too many teams that are going to have a bigger transition in one series to the next than the Warriors are going to have from going to the Kings to the Lakers. They both play fast, but even with that, like, it's just a much different sort of pace that the Kings throw at you. I think Fox is kind of a one-man band in a lot of ways in that regard. But the Warriors are smart, and they have ways to try to force action, even if you want to play more of a drop, which the Lakers like to do and like to kind of have Anthony Davis waiting there at the rim.
That's not going to work. That's not going to work.
Exactly. You can't do that. And the Warriors are going to basically force you to come out and play with them, you know, above the 3-point line just because of who they are. So it's going to be really, really interesting to watch. Steph Curry could go nuts, and that could be the series right there. But if it gets more complex than that, and I imagine that it will, I think the series is more likely to be competitive than it is to just be a blowout of a series. Injuries could also impact that one way or the other, and neither team is immune to those by any means.
I was going to say, Herring, I would argue that the no team is going for a more different opponent than the Lakers going from the Grizzlies to the Warriors, because the Lakers could pack the paint against Memphis in a way they cannot. Even when Golden State is playing Draymond and Looney together, and they'll have two non-shooters on the floor, the fact that you have Steph and Clay's gravity, and you have a competent, like, big wing in Andrew Wiggins, not a Dylan Brooks type, I think changes the calculus of what the Lakers want to do defensively, which is have AD roam the paint, you know, and wall it off entirely. First of all, Steph is so underrated as a finisher, and I'm not saying that he's going to win the matchup against Anthony Davis every time, but even though he might not be going over people like John Morant, is one of the best finishers in the NBA, and will find a way to get to the rim. But yeah, it's just going to be fascinating, because the Warriors are going from having to defend basically Sabonis, who was awful in that series for the most part, unfortunately for him, to now having to deal with Anthony Davis and LeBron in the front court. But the Lakers are going to have to exert so much more energy defensively, particularly in the half court, than they did against Memphis, because even though Golden State, like all teams, you know, every team wants to get on run, Golden State in the half court is going to make you work, is going to make you run around. It's a real fascinating tension for this series, because the Lakers are just, they played incredibly well against Memphis. At some point, I'm going to have to eat crow here, and Mannix can go on the biggest victory lap of all time.
Yeah.
But that, especially sans Luke Kennard in that last game, offensive rebounding, like the Lakers, that series was tailor-made for the Lakers defense in a way this one is not.
Yeah, it's not, because Memphis was one of the worst teams in the playoffs in terms of half-court execution, and the Warriors are like a Swiss watch out there with their movement and their screen setting and all that. On the subject of defending Steph Curry, I do think Jared Vanderbilt is going to be a key here. I think Jared Vanderbilt is going to get a lot of reps on him early on. And on paper, that looks kind of weird. Vanderbilt's like the 6'7", 6'8", you know, combo forward. But he's also, he's really long. He's really athletic. When I talk to people around the league, he has this ability to get through screens really well. It's like a Paul George-esque ability to kind of slip screens. And that's going to be critical in defending Steph Curry. So I think Vanderbilt being effective in that role is going to be key. Obviously, Austin Reeves is going to get reps. Dennis Schroeder is going to get reps. I don't think they put D'Angelo Russell anywhere near him. Like, D'Angelo Russell is a minus defensive player. I think they try to hide him on Andrew Wiggins.
Schroeder's going to play way more.
Schroeder's going to be huge in this series for that reason.
Yeah,
and that's what I was saying.
He's going to be big. I think the I do think that in the subject of fatigue, like which superstar fatigues more and quicker is going to be critical. Like if you're the Lakers, you're probably putting Steph Curry in a million LeBron-centric pick and rolls, right? Like mm-hmm. you want to get a switch so you can get LeBron try to wear Steph Curry out. Like that, and that's a tried and true method. I mean, LeBron did that in these finals. So I do think you're going to see a lot of that. On the flip side, you know, LeBron's going to probably be matched up with Draymond early on, I'm going to guess. Draymond's not an offensive player in terms of shooting, but he's involved in everything. Mm-hmm. Like he's got his hand mm-hmm. in every pie. So LeBron's going to have to be active out there. He's going to have to expend a lot of energy. And look, all credit to him. He looked great in that game six, 9 of 13 from the floor, executed that, you know, reverse dunk in the third quarter. That was amazing. But there were a lot of times in that Grizzlies series that he looked old. Like he looked all of his 38 years. Mm-hmm. And looking old against Memphis is one thing. Looking old against Golden State, which is going to have you in a constant state of motion, whether it's Steph, Clay, Jordan Poole off the bench, it's going to be a challenging series for LeBron stamina-wise. And the fact that it's going every other day is not going to work in his favor, Harry.
I'm curious. I mean, when you asked the question, you started it a little bit more open-ended about like which superstar is going to maybe wear down fastest. I can't ever help but peel my eyes away from Anthony Davis. Like it's just if he gets banged up even for part of a game in the series, I think it's over. I just don't like I'm looking at what the Warriors were able to, what Kevon Looney was able to do. Let me not even broaden it to the Kings on the offensive glass. Obviously Sabonis had a brutal series. I can't remember someone I consider to be a role player having like a bigger moment than Kevon Looney did in quarter three of that game seven. But Davis is just going to be so big here because I feel like if it's just LeBron having to fend for the Lakers, particularly when he's starting to look a bit older in the series, really show his age for the first time in this last series, I just don't think that the Lakers, even you know, as solid as their rotation is, I just think it's too big a mountain to climb if Davis is banged up in any way. So it's not, it wouldn't be a fatigue thing as much as just like a, if he's banged up or if he's hindered in any sort of way from what he normally is, I really think this is the wrong series for that. I think they're evenly matched enough. I don't think either team is going to blow out either team in this series. I think it'll be competitive. But I, you know, I like the Warriors just because I think they've got more answers to some of the questions that are out there about how will each team handle each thing. I think the Warriors will find a way to get it done. I think the Lakers can keep it close and maybe win the series as long as Davis is able to go and is not hindered injury-wise or hampered by anything, an ankle, a knee, a stinger that is particularly bad from one game to the next or anything like that.
I just want to see if in game one LeBron comes out hunting Steph Curry. Because to Mannix's point, he never really had to put his foot on the pedal for a full 48 against Memphis. I think AD was so good defensively. They were getting enough contributions from Reeves, Hachimura, etc. The Warriors are a deeper team than the Grizzlies were, especially considering all the injuries the Grizzlies had. The Warriors are going to have interesting defensive options between Wiggins, GP2, Draymond to throw at some of the different Lakers that I think LeBron is going to have to do more in this series than he did against Memphis. And I'm very interested to see if game one, is he going to come out? Is it going to be like the finals when he's going after Steph on almost every play? Because I think they're going to need something closer to that version of LeBron than the one who they got in Memphis who had moments but was not a LeBron we're used to seeing in the playoffs.
Yeah, on the flip side, if Anthony Davis is healthy, he ain't Sabonis. Like, there's going to be a lot. Mm-hmm. The Warriors are going to have a lot of problems getting those shots at the rim with Anthony Davis lurking out there. Just ask
Looney's going to have to stay out of foul trouble. Yeah.
No question. All right. We will be back on Friday of this week. Subscribe, rate, and review this podcast on your way out. And enjoy the games tonight.
Calling all men. When was the last time you had a really good cry? A recent survey found that women cry on average 5 times a month, while men cry on average only once a month. Studies have shown that crying can support your mental, your physical, and your emotional health. I'm Radhi Devlukia, and on my podcast, A Really Good Cry, we embrace the real, the messy, and the beautiful. Listen to A Really Good Cry on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.